About 2 years ago, my book Rabbit Hole, The Vanishing of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, was released, and I could only think of one place to launch it, Atchison, Kansas, during the Amelia Earhart Festival. It remains one of my very favorite moments of this entire crazy ride. I knew then that a deep ocean search was about to take place, somewhere off the coast of Howland Island, a destination that has now become both ground zero for Crash and Sink, and this investigation as a whole. While we were there, we met tonight's guest. 2 weeks ago, Deep Sea Vision and its CEO Tony Romeo produced a sonar image of what appears to be a mysterious object 16,000 feet below the surface of the Pacific. And that image has got the entire planet talking. Tonight, in a conversation that will rattle this story to its core, Tony makes his Chasing Earhart debut to discuss Crash and Sink, the legacy of Amelia Earhart, and a piece of evidence that could spell the beginning of the end for this story and stop the chase forever. The wait is over. The time is now. Welcome back to the Chasing Earhart podcast. This is Tony Romeo. Tony Romeo, Deep Sea Vision. Welcome to the show, sir. Finally. It's been a long journey.
It has been. Thanks, Chris, for having us.
Absolutely. Well, okay, so I guess I should spill it a little as we start this tonight. This is not the first time we have talked. You and I, we met at my book launch in Atchison.
That's right.
Just a couple summers ago. And I knew then that you were looking at a spot in the deep ocean, somewhere off the coast of Howland. That's all we'll say tonight, unless you say it. Just a short time later, you've completed that initial look at that spot, and you have brought a little something back with you that made this audience in particular very curious. So here's your first question of the night. What have these last few weeks been like for you since this image has become public?
Well, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it. I love the podcast.
Yes. Thank
love
you.
Everybody you've had on. You've done an excellent job with the research. And from what I can tell, very unbiased. And the book, Rabbit Hole, one of the best titled books about Amelia Earhart, I think, ever written. So it was new, it was novel, and very fair. So I thought that was good. So congrats to you on that. Kudos to you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Well, so, I mean, the last few weeks have been terrific. And the folks that we've heard from have been a little bit surprising, actually. We broke the story with the Wall Street Journal, and there were some questions as to, not necessarily from them, but just folks in general, does the Amelia Earhart, does the story still resonate? And so, there was no question that our parents definitely know the story, but the question was, well, do the young generation know about her and, who she was and what she did? And overwhelmingly, the answer is yes. I got an email this morning from a friend that said he went to the library to check out a book on Amelia Earhart for his daughter. And every book at the library had been checked out. To hear stories like that, and another buddy renamed his daughter Amelia after Amelia Earhart. And just all the stories about kids learning about his school and the outreach from different schools wanting us to do Zooms to talk to them about not just Amelia, but the technology and just deep sea exploration has been super exciting. So that for me has been, I didn't expect that at all. The outreach from folks saying, hey, we knew she was there this whole time near the island. I was surprised by how many of those folks were out there. There's this sort of subconscious wisdom. I don't know if that's the collective wisdom, maybe a better way of putting it, that everyone sort of knew where she was this whole time, right? And there were these other fantastic theories, which were fun, but really everyone sort of understands that she went down near the island. And we're presenting, somebody said it the other day, not the best of them. This is the first evidence, Chris, that her plane exists. It really exists. It's not Bigfoot. It really exists. And, we're going to go pull her up.
All right. Well, let's get into it. Let's unpack the image that everybody seems to be talking about. For the record, how did this image come about? How did you discover it? I want to hear it from you because I think that's obviously the purest source. People are very, very curious. So tell me how this all unfolds, essentially.
So the search unfolds in sort of three different parts, 100-day search. Each leg is divided into 30 days with a break in Kiribati. We knew if we were going to tackle this, we had to and make this the longest search, I think the longest search spot, or maybe the longest search spot. I don't know, maybe there was a group out there a bit longer than us. But if we were going to do it the most efficient way possible, we'd have to sort of figure out how can we get our vessel costs down? How can we get our crew costs down? How can we get our fuel costs down? Right. So it was all this calculation. on every piece of the expedition. And if we were able to manage each one of those, then we could stretch out our expedition length. We could search more area. And then it became a sort of mathematical equation for us. We divided the areas that we wanted to search into sectors. And then we sort of, as a group, came up with probabilities for each of those sectors. And then we assigned sort of a difficulty level to each of the sectors. So if it was up close to Howland Island or Baker or another seamount that we knew about, mm-hmm. that made it more difficult. And so we would keep that towards the end. The whole idea was we wanted to hit as much equal probability stuff as quickly as possible and leave the harder stuff, even though it was equal probability, towards the end.
Obviously, this is a team effort. You know, you're one guy. You can't be everywhere. You can't do everything. I was wondering if you could just shout out some of the members of your team as we kind of get into this tonight, because I think people should be recognized for the role they play. And, you know, it's not a one man thing after all. So feel free to shout out some folks that helped you out.
Sure. Yeah, no, I appreciate you asking us tonight. My brother Lloyd was there from the very beginning. Craig Wallace, one of the top sonar guys in the world. We pulled him from Kongsberg when we bought the AUV. You know, just a very personal connection to the Amelia story for him, and super excited to participate in the search. And there were a lot of others that, you know, that weren't on the expedition that, like Tom Detweiler, which I know you know well. You've interviewed. Incredible man. One of the most humble guys I've ever met. And just, he's had his fingers on every single discovery ever happened. And
he's got the most ridiculous resume ever.
Isn't it nuts? It's completely.
And he's got no ego. The ego's gone. It's just
none at all. We invited him to come out. We invited him to come out, actually. And he's so busy with all the projects he's got going, he wasn't able to. Maybe he'll come out for the confirmation. We'll see. But just a terrific guy. So and David, you know, even though we're competitors, I'd say we're friendly competitors. I mean, I think we all share this desire to see the plane found. If somebody else presents evidence that they found something, I'm all ears. Just don't make up the evidence. Yes, I'm not interested in hearing. But if you've got good evidence on, you know, I think there's a couple gaps in knowledge that over next, you know, somebody could fill in. Like I still don't think there's any certainty on was the island mapped incorrectly for her or not. I think that's that would be a nice thing to definitively know. There's some other, I mean, maybe someday somebody will find a map in an attic someplace and bring that forward. But, you know, anyway, it's not getting off on a tangent. But
no,
I mean, there's been a lot of great folks that we've tapped into and spoke to. Dana Timmer, we've spoken to him. He's been very friendly and you know, wants to, you know, help out where he can, forgetting folks here. Liz Smith, of course, with the Dateline.
Yeah, we'll be talking to her soon. I shot her an email the other day. You're doing something that I think is really, well, it's really admirable. I have always said out loud that it's been now 87 years, right, since the disappearance, since July 2nd, 1937, when we lost Earhart and Noonan. There's been a lot of investigation, as you've said, a lot of theory, a lot of speculation, a lot of, is it evidence? Is it not evidence? There's different types of evidence for each theory, for each posit in this case. But I feel like there's been a really bad collapse in any kind of collaboration at all. When you're talking and people are hearing from you and they're hearing from, you know, Bill Snavely and Project Blue Angel, and you know, we're trying to get that Buka 3 going and we're trying to get to that plane out there. And, you know, that's an interesting situation. It's like unfolding behind the scenes as we speak. You've got this incredible image that you've brought back and you're name dropping all these really amazing people. Dave Jordan, I know you've done a lot of research in Elgin Long's work. Personally, I know Liz Smith. I mean, these are really like big names among some newer names that people might not recognize right off the bat, but it's a piece of collaborating that you're doing that I think is going to change how we end this forever. I've always said that's all I care about. I don't care who's right. It's not about who's right. As you said, it's about pulling her up. It's about finding the plane and ending this forever. And I feel like right now, we're closer than we've ever been. There's multiple things going on. People are knocking on the door and the evidence is starting to present potentially. So what has that been like for you working with all these giants and these people and collaborating like that? And is that how you finally crack this kind of a case?
I think so. We went out on this expedition just us as Deep Sea Vision. It was a small group. Again, back to our strategy was we involved fewer people, fewer problems, smaller boat, smaller problems, newer boat, more efficient. We own the equipment. We're not leasing it. Brand new equipment, fewer problems. All these things are advantages that we're trying to stack in our favor. I like the word that you said, collaboration, because I think I think that is the next phase of this. We actually have a call coming up with David Jordan, see if, you know, in the off chance that this isn't the plane, where I'm open end. He's actually brought good skepticism forward that maybe you don't see the end as much as we should, which I think is a very fair argument that we hadn't really considered ourselves. But I mean, I think in that scenario, we try to involve them. We've got the equipment. I own the equipment. I own the Hugin 6000. There's only a handful of those in the world. You know, he's got access to a lot of folks, investors that are interested. You know, I don't know how much more of my own personal money I would, you know, it's been reported I spent $11 million. It wasn't that really not an accurate statement. My goal in this whole thing was to start a deep sea exploration company. And so buying the Hugin was the lion's share of that. The expedition itself was only, you know, a couple million. And for a 100-day search, really, that's, you know, extremely efficient. Like I said, we had six people on our team and then, you know, boat crew and marine crew. You know, we didn't have any to leasing expenses for the equipment. The boat was, I mean, I think there was a couple of days we were under three, believe it or not, Chris, I don't know if this means anything, but we were under 300 liters of fuel for a couple of days out there. And some of these larger boats that have been used in the past, I mean, you're talking 3,000 or 4,000 a day. I mean, it's just it's
insane. Insane.
And we ran in autonomous mode. So we were just handshaking. We would send it on its own. It would run, the boat would idle, and then it would come back. And it was all, again, all part of this strategy. And how can we keep, if we can keep our costs low, then we can search longer. We can search more area.
Beautifully said. And I'm glad that you talked about the cost because, you know, we've speculated about costs and everybody sees the $11 million figure. It's like the 99.999%, you know, on the Nicomoro bone. It's like there's numbers that are really, you know, it's an attractive number. So when people see like $11 million, it's like, wow, this is a lot of money.
Yeah.
So to hear from you that, hey, it actually wasn't that in the grand scheme of things, the expedition part of it wasn't that bad. You know, I think for the technology you brought out and the way you're doing it, you're cutting a lot of fat that a lot of expeditions, you know, have to normally deal with. You guys don't have to deal with that. So you can get a little bit more of a pure search. You can spend more time on a given spot if you guys really drill down on a location. Right. I'm not going to ask you about the location. You have a spot. You're confident. You've got this image now. Tell me what you thought when you saw the image initially. And so I'm sure you've been asked this question 1,000 times, but for our audience, tell us what you thought initially.
Well, Craig was the first one to see it. We had, so we had initially gotten it on, I think, day 32, and it was part of a search we did in an area as we call the Dateline Theory. And we can talk about that in a second, which hasn't been covered too much in the whole story, which I find one of the most fascinating pieces of the whole thing. I think it may be a little bit difficult to explain to folks quickly. You know, initially the data was corrupted, or we thought it was. We're wrapping up the expedition, last day of the expedition, and we had gotten hired to do another search for another aircraft near American Samoa. And we were just basically going through, our camera was broken at this point, but it broke on like day 12, day 11 or day 12. And we didn't use, I mean, it didn't matter to us because we weren't using the camera. We don't, you don't use the camera to search. The camera is your ground truthing. You find something interesting, you go in with the camera. We were so happy with everything that we got in that point. We'd not use the camera. We thought it was the cable that was broken. But anyways, last day of expedition, we're cleaning off our NAS bottle, which contains all the data. And Craig discovered that some of the data was actually salvageable. And he came and ran down, came and got us and said, you guys got to take a look at this. And it was just one of those moments, you know, it was surreal. And, you know, we didn't know right then for sure that it was it, but golly, man, of all everything that we've been looking at for hours and hours and hours for the previous 100 days, that was it. I mean, that was, I mean, so it was a bittersweet moment. You know, we all said like, shit, this is, we had this the whole time and here we are. But I just remember thinking, this is, God, we're the first ones to see our plane in, you know, however many decades, 86 years. And definitely a moment you'll remember. We had a bottle of 1937 Scotch. I don't know if you read this story, Scotch whiskey Craig.
Tell it though.
Yeah. And we had saved it for the moment. And we, you know, I was kind of saying, I think this is right, guy. I think it feels right, the right moment though. And getting Craig to bring us along on the trip was trying to pry it out of his hand was already. And so he said, no, we can't do this. So we shut down so we had to decide, what do we do? So we were at this point, we were several days. We were a couple days away, about 3 days away from where, 2 days away, I think, from where the site was. So we shut down Starlink. We went dark for everybody. We didn't tell the Marine crew what was going on because we didn't want anybody to have suspect any kind of discovery was made. And we just made the decision that, well, we're too far away. Anybody that was tracking us, which I don't like to be paranoid about stuff, but maybe
it's a good point.
There. Yeah. Aside from all the cool stuff in the air, there's a bit, you know, there's a lot of people are interested in an airplane and to find it would be, you know, financially
the holy grail. It is holy grail.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we decided let's clean the image up. Let's, we found it in a completely different spot from where we were when we initially when we saw the discovery. And so we said, well, we can publish this image. We didn't have a documentary team. That was, I think, the biggest consideration for us. We didn't have a documentary. I had let them, we did have a documentary team. Day 30, we let them go because they were getting seasick, and we were doing the same thing over and over and over. And we said, okay,
it's well, a long time.
It was. And one of the guys just was really struggling with it. Unfortunately, you get out of the sea, you don't know. I didn't get sick at all. And it's nothing like, it's not nothing I did. I mean, I didn't prepare myself any, but I just, some guys get over it and some guys just actually never get over it. So anyways, we said, we'll come back with a proper documentary team, maybe an ROV. Definitely a camera that's working. We're still waiting for our camera to get installed. The parts are extremely hard. It's a very specialized camera, obviously, go down to 6,000 meters. But so that's the next steps.
It's an exciting time to be in this Earhart game. I will keep saying it until I'm blue in the face. It really is. I think we're close. I think we're really close. I think someone's got it. I think someone's got it right. It's compelling. And for me, as someone who does what I do and as ingrained as I've been in it for as long as I have, I want this to be over. I really want this to be over. So my email, my phone, everything's been ringing off the hook since that image dropped. Like, is this it? Is this that? Well, I'm going to talk to him. We're going to hear from him. If you just suspend theory for a while and you look at something Tom Detweiler said way back on our show, he said, sometimes it's not one big thing that happens that causes these wrecks. It's really the sum of a lot of little things that just go wrong. You know, if you listen to Earhart, she was basically saying where she was. Jen and I have talked about this ad nauseum. You know, you've heard the show. We talked about fuel. We talked about the radio logs. We talked about the Itasca. We talked about it to death with Tom Vinson, with Detweiler, with everybody that we had on the show. You know, those logs, you have to put trust in what she was saying. And she was saying about 200 miles out, about 100 miles out. We must be on you, but cannot see you. Things of that right. nature. If there's a spot in the deep ocean, pardon my French, it's a big ass ocean. And it's a lot of money to search and to run these searches. It's not cheap for you guys to find it in the manner that you found it and the way that it happened. It's just, it's kind of a beautiful story. It's kind of a really, it's a really poetic ending. Yeah. So I have pushed for Buka 3. We're trying to get Buka 3. We intend to go. We started something. We want to finish it. We have a plane. Sure. We know it's there. All of that. But if this is it, I am overjoyed at being able to say it's over, because I've always thought we need to focus on what really matters, which is the legacy, which you talked a little bit about.
Appreciate
as we
that.
Open.
No, yeah, I so really like, appreciate seeing that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I congratulate you for it. I think it's impressive. I think the steps you are taking and the way you are doing it, I think is impressive. I think the technology you're using is cutting edge. It's really neat. You guys, the way you're leaning into the technology to help you when, you know, where history has sort of failed, I think is really, it's poetic. It's pretty nice. So I, you know, hey, I saw that image and people thought I was crushed. And I'm like, no, man, I am happier than I've ever been. This is great.
I appreciate that. No, I really appreciate that. That's where I know your intentions are absolutely in the right spot. Anyone that's out there can, I mean, that's fine. I have no problem with the skepticism. I think
it's healthy. Sure.
Right. I think that's great. I think, and if this turns out not to be a plane, I'm going to 100% be a cheerleader for the next person to carry the torch. And I hope this is found in our lifetime. You know, it's such a beautiful riddle. It's such a fun problem. You know, I used to think we had maybe 20% of information. And as you dig more into it, and that's why I love your title, Rabbit Hole. It's, you know, you realize, I don't think it is 15 or 20. I think we only have maybe 3 or 4, maybe 5% of the information that we need to solve this. And that's why it's still out there. You know, those 6 last radio calls she made, the 200 to the 100, there's clearly a problem there. She couldn't have covered that distance in the 30 minutes, right? And then she says, we must be on you, but cannot see you flying 1,000 feet. So, I mean, there's tons of clues packed into that one. 1,000 feet. Well, we know she's coming down from 8,000 feet. Mm-hmm. She doesn't the winds at 1,000 feet, right? She knew about 8,000 because they're measuring their distance as they're going across. They're doing a celestial navigation, so he has a pretty good gauge on his wind, his ground speed. But when he gets to 1,000 feet, he doesn't. He's not no longer celestial navigating. He's just taking sun lines, so he's not sure the distance he's covering. So he doesn't know. He can't calculate the wind speeds anymore. And that was, I think, a very significant clue. And I haven't seen very many folks key in on that they didn't know the wind speeds coming in. At 1,000 feet, they were probably around eight knots, maybe 25 knots. So possibly Noonan's thinking they're flying against stronger headwinds than they actually are encountering.
Reverse.
Low on fuel.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a pilot. I'll tell you the last thing I would ever say on the radio is I'm low on fuel. I would never want to say that. No pilot ever wants to say that. You're admitting the biggest F up that you could do as a pilot. That's it. You cannot have messed up more than. And so for her to come on the radio and say low on fuel, or some people say 30 minutes, whatever, we can know.
Gas is running low. Yeah.
Right. Whatever it is. The point is she's low on gas. She wasn't just low on gas, Chris. She was out of gas. For her to make that statement, she was out of gas. Trust me. There has been known airplane crashes where the pilots bury an airliner into the ground because they were too embarrassed to admit they were out of gas. And so we always kind of work backwards from that. We always felt that was the most important call. We must be on you, because that's the moment that triggers a lot of events. They think that they're at the island at that moment. So if you work backwards from there, an hour or two when she said, well, she was 100 miles out and then back to 200, then you start realizing, well, her 200 mile call was the one that was off. And she corrects it to get to the 100 because it's actually 100 miles from 100 miles to we must be on you. That's a true 100 miles because she's flying 133, 130 mm-hmm. miles somewhere in there. Something happens between 200 and 100. Well, two events happen. She crossed the international date line and the sunrise happens. Carry on after we must be on you. She says, call us on the radio. Next one, we can't hear you on the radio. Try reaching us on voice. There's tons of clues packed in each one of those. When she says, we heard your signals, what is she telling us when she's saying that? She's saying, the guys on the boat are saying S1, S3, S5, right? They're louder, louder, louder. Well, what is she also hearing on the Morse code signal? She's also hearing louder, louder, louder as well. She's not saying S3S, but she's also telling us by saying, we're hearing your signals loud, really loud. We know we're really close to you. Mm-hmm. And when we kind of had that realization, oh, wow, she's telling us that she's hearing us louder and louder now. Not just she's hearing the signals, but she might be at the point where she's heard the signals as the loudest that she's ever heard them. And then, of course, her last call, she says, we're on the 157337 line. Our interpretation of this has not always been that that's a sun line. That's the line that connects Baker and Howland Island. And that's a really important point because Baker is on the exact, the bearing 337 from Howland Island.
Mm-hmm, if that's right.
Fred was going to consider an alternate landing point, it would have been Baker. That would have been Baker. For one choice. It's 37 miles away. I'm going to go to Baker before I go to any other island in the Pacific. And so when he's saying 157337 at 8:43 a.m., which the sun line was no longer 157337, by the way, it was actually 154341. So it had changed. So for her to make that call 157 at a time when the sun line was no longer 157 indicates to me, actually, wait a minute. She's referencing the line between the islands because she knows that her best shot at this right now is to stay on that line that connects the two islands. Because if she stays on that line, she has a chance of hitting two islands. If she starts changing her bearing to 3154 or even less, she's now going to be off. She's not going to be lining up with those two islands. So yeah, I don't think we're the first ones to realize that, but I think there's this common wisdom that that was the sun line. I mean, it was a nice coincidence at sunrise that 157 also matched up with the line of the islands, but they knew they needed to fly the line between the islands because if they overflew Howland or missed it from the air or couldn't see it because of the clouds, they could still have a shot at Baker. And that was really important. Having an alternate landing point out there was really, really important. So searching around Baker became a very high priority for us. There's a little clue for you.
And there you go. All right. Let's have a little fun and talk a little bit of theory, talk a little speculation, and then we'll kind of wrap up. So I know it's late for you, so I don't want to keep you up too late.
No problem. But, I love this stuff.
Well, yeah, no, you can hear it in your voice. That's the passion that, you know, it's going to change this case. It's going to end this case. That's what we want. I hear the same stuff when I talk to Bill. He's fired up about Buka. He thinks he's got it. I think that's great for the case.
I talked to some guys about the Buka thing. We actually were corresponding with some folks out there. And my problem with the Buka thing is that if she calls out 157337, and I don't know who responded to our email, if it was him or somebody else. And and the response we got back was that wasn't her. So the thing with the 157337, if you say that's the sun line, or she was referencing a sun line at Buka at that time when she's calling that, it was still nighttime, right?
Yeah.
So there has to be another explanation for the 157. This is where I get frustrated with these, is that the response, and again, I don't know who in the team responded, but they said that was not her that's saying that. That was the telegram, that was the radio operator that wrote that down, just assuming that that's what she meant. And so now if you start taking away or adding stuff from the record, we were very intentional when we went out there. We're not going to take anything away from the record. We're not going to add anything to the record. We're going to take these six last messages and dissect each one in a very kind of analytical way and take the inverse meaning, not just what she's saying, but what's the inverse? Like when she's saying she heard her signals, what does she also see? She's saying she's hearing the signals very loudly. She's hearing them louder than what she had before. There's some frustration for me when these theories start adding the post-loss stuff. There's nothing, I mean, and I think you probably agree with me on that. There's never been any credible post-loss signals that have been verified. So, I mean, you just...
Lots of content for sure.
Tons
but
of.
It's, yeah, tons of content. And maybe that's the problem, right? Is that this case has become so content laden that it's just, it's hard to decipher what's real from what's truth.
So true. All the articles have been written the last few days. Every single one of them has a mistake. It's so
yeah.
Funny.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I won't put you on the spot, certainly. Talk about what only you feel comfortable with, of course. I'll tell you the same thing I tell everybody on the show. But I will ask you that the image drops, You guys are in the news. You know, you're all over the world, essentially. I mean, every time, I think you and I can both agree, anytime any kind of piece of evidence, regardless of theory, hits, it sets the world on fire. That's the phrase we use. It really does, because everybody's talking about Earhart again. And it seems to happen like every couple of years, something will happen, will come up, and then it'll just blow up. I know that there's a lot going on behind the scenes because I'm sort of in it. This image drops, you guys go public, and all this stuff happens. And immediately, I know, people come out of the woodwork and try to tell you that you're wrong and that it couldn't be hers because dot, dot, dot. We've heard people talk about the swept wings and kind of the way that look and all that stuff. And obviously there's going to be skepticism from certain people, from certain areas of the Earhart investigation. How do you deal with that as somebody that's coming into this with this piece of evidence that you think is really compelling? You talked about that really awesome moment when you guys feel like you discovered it. How do you deal with that? And or does it, is it just like shaking off a bad case of fleas? Doesn't really bother you guys because you know what you're doing. You know what the end game is.
I think it's fun. For me, this was, you know, a complete life change, a whole new adventure, a whole new journey chapter in my life. And it's been exceptionally rewarding and fun. And the people we've met, so it's been, even the folks have been skeptical, I've been very, I think, very professional and polite about it. I have no, I have no bone to pick with anyone. I think that it's, you know, I think it adds to the whole story. I mean, and even if the crazy, you know, flat earthers out there think she's flying underneath the planet, I got an email from a guy that it was a god on the Sunvier planet and in the Delphin galaxy, and we should start focusing. I mean it's just all fun but at the end of the day, we really do want to solve it. That's why we're here, is because there's been so many theories, and it's, you know, it's just America's favorite missing person. I still have the else, but I really like it. And it's true. She is a very America's favorite missing person. And as long as that plane is missing, there is going to be somebody out there coming up with a story on what happened to her. There's going to be somebody looking for her. And 2 years ago, when we decided we were going to do this, you know, he made the comment, this one's not going to be out there much longer. And you sort of alluded to that earlier. Five years. I mean, that was what we said. I mean, with the technology that's there, you know, this isn't it. We're either going to find it here in a subsequent search, or somebody else is going to find it. Anybody that's attached themselves or their ego to an idea, you know, they just better be ready for the the image that's going to come out. So that's all I have to say. It's very clear where she went down. There's not, amongst the real researchers, I in my opinion, I should say, I think there's very, it's a lot of clear evidence that she got very close to the island, and she was a really good pilot.
She was.
She had one of the best navigators. So I don't think a couple just things, unfortunate. Her radio was broken. Her receiver was broken, it appears. And she may have run into a little bit of weather at one point, which caused her to descend sooner than she had wanted to. And then possibly an error on the map on where the island was located. You know,
a sum of a lot of little things.
And just, I mean, in 20 hours into the flight, you start making mistakes. It's just, it happens. Tired, exhausted, adrenaline, frustrated.
The human factor.
You imagine the conversation that must have been going. They couldn't talk, right? They were
screaming at each other, if at the very least.
And then that moment, I just, in my head, I always imagine it. The engines cut out, she has to start gliding at about 60 knots towards the water, and it's like for maybe a minute, 2 minutes, they could hear each other and talk to each other, right? And
God, what that conversation so must have been like.
You imagine?
No, I don't know that I want to. It's
oh, I know. You imagine what I mean. Who was more mad at who at that point? I don't know. I mean, I and that's part of it, you know, not to make light of it, but the situation was very much as a pilot, like I think about, did Amelia, was she listening to Fred at the end? Was she taking his instruction? Did she allow him to get a good solid sunline? And or was she, at that point, she panicked and just said, you know, she started using her own intuition. One thing about her, she was very calm. And until the end, she seems to be very calm, very composed, very collected. And then at the end, of course, we hear her frantic radio call. But she seems to be very, you know, very collected about the whole thing up until right the end. Was she allowing Fred to give her inputs and navigational inputs? I don't know. And that's the ultimate question, is was she, and why wasn't Fred talking on the radio a little bit? Was he more valuable to her looking out the windows, or did she have him in his books and his charts trying to figure out the, I think it was more valuable to have him looking out the window.
At that point, sure.
Yeah.
You mentioned something really interesting, and we talked about it a lot on the show. We talked about the idea of a pancake landing and the idea of her dropping to 1,000 feet, and maybe that being a preventative measure. You know, maybe that was an idea that, hey, if I can put this plane on the ground, you know, we've had so many people talk about that plane. If you can put it on the, not on the ground, I should say, if you put it on the water in a decent enough way, it would kind of be like a ping pong ball with wings if it wasn't punctured. But with all those fuel tanks in there, if that thing goes down really hard, it sinks relatively quickly. What's your thought on that? What condition do you think the plane was when it actually touches the water.
I think it remained intact. I think it flipped over is what happened. So being out there, you know, a lot of folks would say, well, she would have timed the waves and the swells to kind of land between. But I'll tell you, you can't see that. As you're flying in, and the best thing she could have done was turn the plane into the wind, turn it toward facing the east, try to slow the plane down, flare it right at the end, and then right maybe 50 feet or 100 feet above the water, then she starts seeing the waves. And I mean, we're at the equator. I can tell you that there was no day that we saw waves bigger than maybe 2 meter, maybe a 3 meter day. But I mean, you're talking small waves. I mean, there was one day it was just flat, calm, like a pool. That's doldrums. That's the equator for you. So she would have had a really good shot at landing it in very, very calm seas. And by all accounts from other Electras that have crash landed in the waters, they've all remained intact as well. The gas tanks does provoke a lot of questions because they were big tanks. They were specially fitted for the plane to carry extra fuel, as you mentioned. And so do those keep the plane afloat for a bit? I think it's possible, but I do think the plane, because of the center of gravity was forward, she sort of pancakes it down, and then maybe the tail, as she's trying to just kind of keep the nose above the water, the tail hits the water, which forces the nose down, and immediately the intakes, those big intakes on those engines, catch the water, and it flips the plane over. Yeah. If the plane flipped over,
it'd be a violent flip. No,
it would be a violent flip, exactly. Yeah. That radio thing, that transmitter was right up near her forehead. She would hit that, and then the hatch that would have let her out of the plane would have been nearly impossible for her to get out of. I mean, we find the plane. I think that might be one of the most interesting things, is the hatch open? You know, the three questions that I think are just going to be fascinating to know is the hatch open? What radio frequency is set to on the dial, right? Because her last transmission was, oh, we're on the line 157-337, we're on 6210, right? But she never did. She never switches over, or at least we never hear her on 6210, which is her daytime frequency. So yeah, did she ever switch over? I think that's a fascinating question. Thirdly, what do we find in the plane as far as artifacts, ring, yeah, button? I was reading a thing yesterday about this very nice, very distinctive watch that she had. So that, I mean, there are a few things like that I think should still be in the plane, and also with Fred. And then maybe even the little notes that they were writing back and forth. There's a possibility some of those
wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't that be something? You know, this is kind of a heartbreaking conversation to have tonight in a way, because you're sort of forced to think about the final moments. You know, look, I've always maintained that trying to pick one of these outcomes is horrible. But as you're describing it, talking about some of the things you're talking about, and me thinking about Leo Bellaerts, and Leo Bellaerts on our very own show saying she sounded like it wasn't a whistle. History states, or history shows a lot of times, that it was a whistle, that she was trying to whistle into the, right, but at the last, right, final moments, it was a scream. Yeah. And he said, I'll never forget that. And I remember hearing that for the first time and just thinking, God damn. Like,
it's scary, right?
I can't imagine being Leo Bellaerts in that situation.
One quick thing on Leo Bellaerts, his son, I just want to hit Dave Bellaerts.
Oh, Dave Bellaerts, yes.
Very awesome guy. He's still alive. His son, yep, up in Tacoma, met with him. He gave us a copy of the Fun of It, by signed by Amelia Earhart, to take with us out on the trip. So, which was, I thought, a very, very kind gesture, very kind man. And
he's a good man.
We asked him, is there anything your dad ever told you about? He said one thing. He said, dad said, well, there's one thing he's going to take to the grave. He's never going to tell anyone. I'm like, he never told him, or I don't know if he told that to you, but.
He did tell me that story, but yeah, I remember him telling us that when we went to Washington to talk with him and Leo Jr. before Leo Jr. passed. We got them on film and together and talking to them. And I remember,
very cool. Good.
Yeah, they did mention that. Very cool. So Dave Bellaerts, if you're listening to this, shout out to you, sir. You are a treasure, and you've been amazing for this case and for everybody involved in it. Again, no ego, without prejudice. He gives to everybody. He supports everybody. Absolutely. That's how you end this. I think what's really interesting, and I've told this to Bill, full transparency with you, but whoever's right, you become her biographer of sorts. Like you basically tell her final moments, and you talking about some of the artifacts that potentially could be there. And then we know at those depths can be pretty well preserved. Mm-hmm. That part of the story makes me feel like not only can we end this, but we can really end this. Like this can be it. And so tonight, we're about 40 minutes into this. I promise I'm going to let you get to sleep. I got one final question. And I'm just going to ask you very bluntly, have you finished this? Is this over? What's your gut tell you?
My gut tells me we found it, and I feel really good about what we have. I'm not also the kind of guy that's going to put a cork back in the champagne bottle. We are going to do this right. We've invited the Earhart family to come be a part of seeing the plane for the first time in 87 years. And this is going to happen soon. This isn't, we're not going to leave this out there very long. The Earhart family will be there. We've talked to the Putnam family as well to bring a representative out. I think that's important.
Love that.
So they don't expect the plane to come up anytime soon. Let's put it that there's a lot of steps between now.
Yes. It takes some time. Site,
yep. Bringing it up properly so it's not damaged. And then the other side of things, just to be very clear, if this isn't it, then we continue the search. We've got three or four areas that we could easily go back and add. We're talking to David George, but I don't like to get too down that path, because then it's like, oh, well, you aren't confident of what you found. We feel good about what we found, but at the same time, the whole idea here was we bought the equipment to find Amelia. So to do a business, get into the mineral business, you know, do other searches, possibly MH370 at some point, which I think would be a as well.
But, would it ever?
It would be. So after this, you need to, that needs chasing MH370. That's your new,
Well, I'll wait till you take a look at it. You might knock that one out pretty quick. I think once you, if you wrap this Earhart thing, it's going to be a whole nother level for you guys. And look, stick the landing. I think it's beautiful. And I appreciate you coming on tonight, and I think it's amazing. And keep us posted.
Thanks, Chris. No, I appreciate what we've done over the years, getting everyone together. It's been super. It's been terrific. And I know a lot of folks have mentioned your name and that you've done an excellent job. So I appreciate that. And it's all collaborative. We're working towards just finally bringing some closure and bringing Amelia home. So it's such a great story. It's such an awesome story. And it's such a fun riddle that's just like, just from a mathematical perspective on how to try to dissect all the information and put it into something that you can actually go out and create a search grid and do. It's just been an incredible, fun analytical project. So, and the guys that are on our team, I'm extremely proud of them for what they did. Amelia was such a wonderful person, and not a lot of people know this about her. She was a terrific author. And I'm sure they should be pushing for the fun of it. One of the best books. She's so witty, so gracious, and never said anything bad about anybody. But you knew when she didn't like someone. But
yeah, the quips were there.
The quips are just so. She's just. So good. And just, I mean, you know, we lost her at 39. She had so much time ahead of her, but even in that short amount of time, she was phenomenal. So I'm really, really happy to be part of this story, no matter what happens here.
Well, from one tired Earhart researcher to another, get some sleep. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate you. We'll
Thank
talk
you,
soon.
Chris. Yep. Sounds good. We will.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.